The name Yitzhak Shavet is not exactly a household word, even in Israel. Dr. Shavet, who is an Egyptian-born nuclear physicist in Rehovot, was relatively unknown outside the circle of his professional colleagues and his family. Until some 5 weeks ago, the Prime Minister of Israel, Menachem Begin, suddenly announced that Dr. Shavet was his candidate for the presidency of the state. The office of president in Israel is a largely ceremonial one, and the present incumbent will complete his term at the end of May. Now, the man who fills that office, in a sense, is the ceremonial head of the state. He appears for Israel at various international conferences. He welcomes dignitaries to Israel and so on. And the appointment of an election of a new president is not a matter of international concern. But in this case, the method by which Menachem Begin selected Shavet for nomination is of interest, because it says a good deal, I believe, about the habits of his leadership. And I think it suggests to us some of the reasons that his leadership this first year of the State of Israel has not been marked with unusual success. It turns out that Begin had really never met Dr. Shavet until he determined on his candidacy. He was hosting in the Prime Minister's office one day in early March a meeting of physicists, scientists, on some conference or committee, and the man whom he should nominate, the issue of nomination was uppermost in his mind, and over coffee after the meeting he asked the men whom they would recommend. The name of Dr. Shavet came up, and the fact that he was a Sephardi, an Oriental Jew who had one of the few in Israel who had won acclaim in an area of Western technological competence, immediately appealed to the dramatic instinct of Mr. Begin. It would be a way of symbolizing the united community in Israel. And he went out of the room and he walked into the presence of his group of reporters, and he suddenly announced that Dr. Yitzhak Shavet was his nominee for the office of the presidency. Now, it turned out, as the reporters scurried around to find out who Dr. Shavet was, that Mr. Begin himself could not tell them a great deal about him. Indeed, he had to summon Dr. Shavet home from Paris, where he was attending an international scientific conference, to have a talk with him. And in the end, Dr. Shavet will not become the new president of the state, because Mr. Begin had not done his political homework. He had not consulted with the leading members of his own party, who after all constitute a majority in the Knesset, and the Knesset must elect the man who occupies this office. And many of them had one or another senior diplomat or statesman in Israel as their preferred candidate. And when this man was suddenly sprung on them, they were not about to let go of their own preference. Mr. Begin is a man who is moved to impulsive acts. He's a man who has a flair for dramatic, who has great confidence in his own powers of judgment, who is not used to staff work and not ready to depend upon a staff. His ideas are often good ideas, but in the execution, they often fail to achieve what he hoped they would achieve. And if you find this parallel between Mr. Begin and a certain president of the United States in this respect, the parallel I would suggest to you is quite apt. Let me give you several examples of the way in which the peacock in Mr. Begin has stood in the way of the success of his own plan. When he's elected to the Prime Ministership of Israel in the late spring of last year, he was ill-known on the international scene and much suspected. And you remember that when he came to Washington in July of 1977, he came known as a fanatic, as an ideologue, as a man who would be impossible to deal with, as a terrorist, an ex-terrorist. Very little was said about the statesman, about the thinker, about his principles. All people had were a few labels. Now, in July 1977, the relationships between Israel and the United States were not at their best. Our own president had come into office in January and had suddenly announced that for the Middle East, 1977 was going to be the year of Geneva. And by the end of the year, he would arrange for all of the parties to be sitting around the table negotiating. Now, not all the parties obviously were willing to come around the table. It had been a difficult spring. And the more unwilling the Arabs became, the more obdurate, the more Mr. Carter had begun to pressure Israel to do all the things ahead of Geneva that he thought the Arabs would want. And the pressures had already begun to mount. As the spring came into early summer, he became more and more frustrated, our president, with the Middle East. It was not resolving itself. And when Israel elected a prime minister who represented a party which was more obstinate than the party in power, more demanding of security than the party in power, Mr. Carter was not prone to look upon this occurrence favorably. But when Begin came to Washington, he conducted himself with remarkable acumen. He had a number of very significant conferences with the media. And he left Washington known now as a statesman, one among the statesmen of the world. And his relationships with Mr. Carter, though they were not always easy, were agreeable, and they seemed to have devised a way of speaking relatively openly and easily with each other. Much was accomplished in July in Washington. And then you recall Mr. Begin went back to Jerusalem. And the next thing we heard from Jerusalem was a sudden announcement that Kadum and several other unauthorized settlements in the West Bank had suddenly been authorized, legitimatized by the state. And this act was not only impulsive, but foolish. Nothing was changed. The settlements were already in place. There was no demand on the table officially that these settlements be removed, that a single new settler was added to these settlements by the official pronouncement from Jerusalem. What obviously had happened is that Mr. Begin had come back to Jerusalem very pleased with himself, and that he committed the fatal flaw of politicians to play to the grandstand, play to his own disciples. And he wanted to show them that he had stood up to Mr. Carter. And since Mr. Carter was very unhappy with the whole idea of these unauthorized settlements, by goodness, he was going to see that they were declared authoritative and legitimate. And so he did. And so in exchange for a purely symbolic act, a self-gratifying act, Mr. Begin won for himself the enduring enmity of Mr. Carter. Because Mr. Carter could only interpret this act as a slap in his face. And more than this, when Israel explained that the issue had never come up in the discussions between Begin and Carter, and therefore Israel was not in any way going back on the word which had been pledged, all that this succeeded in doing was revealing to the world that Mr. Carter was not a very well-prepared or astute negotiator, that he had not raised certain basic issues, and no one likes to have his innocence exposed in public. In exchange for, you know, a moment of glory in the eyes of his disciples and his adherents, Mr. Begin substituted for a good bit of goodwill in Washington, a good bit of anger and distance. Another example. In March of this year, things had considerably worsened in the relationship between Israel and Washington. Mr. Carter had not been able to achieve his 1977 Geneva conference. In his desperation to reach that goal, he had tried finally to embroil the Soviet Union in the Middle East, and this had so frightened both Egypt and Israel that they had gone behind the back of the United States, and they'd organized the Sadat-Begin summit in Jerusalem. And after that summit, the United States had plunged itself back into the negotiations and had come back in with its favorite idea that it must involve all the parties in the area. And to achieve it, somebody in Washington had convinced Mr. Carter there would have to be a statement of political positions that would be basic to the negotiations. And since Hussein and Assad and the Palestinians were not represented in the current negotiations, Israel was in a very difficult position. She was being asked to commit herself on paper to positions which were apt to be negotiated when the groups would finally, and countries would finally come to the negotiating table. Israel proved adamant. Washington began to try and turn the screws to force Israel's hand. And in the process, there were a number of very unfortunate contretemps between the two countries. In any case, the Sadat had come to Washington, and Mr. Carter had proclaimed him to be the world's foremost apostle of peace. And Mr. Begin was going to be faced in Washington with some very difficult negotiations, and yet, by coming to Washington, he had the opportunity, if not to convince the president, at least to convince public opinion in the United States, that the position that the United States had taken was not only in many ways unfortunate, but it was self-defeating. After all, it was Egypt, not Israel, which had initiated the war in 1973. It was Egypt, not Israel, which had been defeated in the war in 1973. It was Egypt and not Israel which had arbitrarily broken off the negotiations in early February of 1978. It was Israel which was willing to sit down with anyone and everyone to negotiate, and Jordan, Syria, and the Palestinians who were not willing to sit down and to negotiate directly. It was the self-proclaimed policy of the United States that we would be a facilitator of the negotiations, but not the compulsory arbitrator of them, that we not declare what our plan would be. And yet, in effect, Carter, by making certain requirements of Israel, was declaring what that plan for negotiations must be. He was leaning on Israel, Goliath, on the little country, and he was not leaning upon Egypt, even though Egypt had failed to live up to many of the pledges which had been given by Mr. Sadat to Mr. Carter at Aswan, particularly the pledge to coerce Hussein into coming into the negotiations. There was much that could be accomplished in March and April of 1978 in Washington, in making clear why it was that Israel is concerned with security, questions of security, that the simple issue of a Palestinian state pulling back to the boundaries of 1967 do not meet one of the basic needs of the area, stability, which can come only from military security. And Mr. Begin would have had a very powerful argument ready-made. The United States Senate was debating the Panama Canal Treaty. The Panama Canal Treaty envisages 22 years of continuing American military control over the canal for reasons of military security. And the senators were very much concerned with how we protected our national interests after the year 2000. And these issues were very on the top of everybody's mind for Israel to make certain demands in a much more compacted and much more explosive part of the world surely could be seen as reasonable within the context of 30 years of war. But just before he was due to set out for Washington, Mr. Begin allowed it to come out from the cabinet that the government of Israel no longer accepted the Resolution 242, the United Nations Resolution of 1967, which had been heretofore assumed by the United States and by Israel to be an adequate basis for negotiations, and by default, by silence, had been accepted by Mr. Sadat as a basis for negotiations. Now, each country interpreted the resolution differently. But the point was that it was on the table and had been generally accepted. And now suddenly, in March of this year, Mr. Begin announces that Israel no longer accepts 242 as relevant to either the West Bank or the Golan Heights. Now, if something new had been achieved by this declaration, if, in fact, Israel was claiming the right to annex this territory, rights of sovereignty which had heretofore not been claimed, if it made some difference on the ground, I could have begun to deal with and perhaps to understand the declaration. But in point of fact, as with his declaration a year previous, nothing was changed. Immediately the announcement was made, Israel repeated that she was not linking settlement and sovereignty. that she was not demanding the annexation of the West Bank, that she was talking about positions of military security, all of which were points which had long since been on the table and long since recognized by the world community and even by the United States to a certain degree as legitimate for negotiation, issues for negotiation. And so when Mr. Begin arrived in Washington 2 weeks ago, it was very easy for the administration to turn the table. And instead of Mr. Begin being able to say to the American news media, look how the United States has changed its position and gone back on what it had promised before, all our administration had to say is, look how Mr. Begin has gone back on his position. Israel accepted 242, and now they no longer do. And Mr. Begin wonders a little bit back in Jerusalem why it is that the United States sees him, not necessarily the administration, but some of the people in the United States see him as an obstacle to peace, as a very difficult man who is unwilling to unbend to be forthcoming in these negotiations. I would suggest that his own habit of leadership has a good deal to do with it. He talks too freely. He loves the dramatic gesture. He plays to his home audience. He does not do necessarily the staff work that needs to be done. And all of this is costly for any national leader. As a matter of fact, if I were to analyze the condition in the Middle East today, I would say that we suffer from the tragedy of having three political innocents, as leaders of the major parties involved, Egypt, Israel, and the United States. In each case, these men love the bold statement. In each case, these men believe themselves to be dealing in visionary concerns. In each case, these men are not well trained to deal on a staff level, on a tactical level, with the very basic issues. They prefer to not pay much attention to economic and political and military questions until they have to. In each case, they are leaders who need a press secretary who follows after them and who always has a prepared speech for the media after one of the leader has made his pronouncement, that this is not, in fact, what the leader intended to say. It happens in Washington, it happens in Jerusalem, it happens in Cairo. There's an old rabbinic principle, Ein Am Haaretz Hasid, which can be freely translated that you don't look for political success to the politically innocent. And unfortunately, in each of the countries, a man has come to power who is probably a good man, basically, but he's not used to power and not used to the awesome responsibilities, the care, the meticulous care which must be exercised by a head of state in his relationships with other heads of state. A man who is too easily confuses his own ego, his own self, needs of self, with the needs and the future of the state. Mr. Sadat came to Jerusalem as an innocent. It was a bold gesture. It was an impulsive gesture. It was a welcome gesture. But it was very clear that Mr. Sadat had no idea how to follow up on this gesture, how to sit down and how to negotiate. In fact, he seems not to have been prepared to negotiate at all. He was more than willing to announce in Jerusalem what the maximal demands of the Arabs were, not to sit down and to argue as to this or that base, this or that demilitarized zone, this or that policy for the West Bank. And when he finally, a few days after the summit, began to sit down and to look over the proposals which Israel had submitted, which had to do with the demilitarized zone in the Sinai, which had to do with Israel's continuing political sovereignty over a number of small settlements near the Gaza Strip, some new relationship for the islands at the bottom of the Gulf of Eilat, Sharm el-Sheikh. His first impulse was to accept this as legitimate. And he so indicated these were fair issues for negotiation to the Israeli government. And then when he went home and his foreign minister and others who were in his department said, but that's not our policy, that's not what we ought to be doing, he suddenly had to reverse himself, and the Egyptian ministry had to announce that Mr. Sadat had in fact not intended to say what he did say. Now, at the moment, this particular innocent is riding high. For reasons of the innocence of the United States and the innocence of Mrs. Begin, he is in a moment in a favorable position. His picture is appearing in all of our media, crowned as the next Nobel laureate for peace. But as a point of fact, when we get to that stage where Israel and Egypt do, in fact, sit down, and where there must be adjustments as to the Sinai, there must be adjustments as to the Gulf of Eilat, there must be adjustments as to the economic consequences which will follow from some kind of arrangement, when there must be the hard-headed, realistic negotiations, which is what, after all, negotiations are all about, I think Mr. Sadat will find it very difficult to conduct these negotiations. He's a man of impulse, not a man who likes to button things down. The major problem, I think, is not the impulsiveness or the peacock quality of Mr. Begin, or the impulsiveness and the innocence of Mr. Sadat, but is, I think, to be laid at this point to Washington. Mr. Carter, as I indicated, came into power with great hopes to solve all the problems of the world. He came on a rather sermonic campaign trail. I think preachers understand Mr. Carter far better than anybody else in our body politics, because it's very easy on a Sunday morning to solve all the problems of the world. All you have to do is be sweetly reasonable. You don't have to deal with unreasonable people or unreasonable states or hard economic and political issues which will simply not dissolve because you'd like to see them disappear. He's a man of a good heart. But he's also a man who has very little recognition of how difficult it is in our world for men to sit down together, because people simply do not sit down together and solve their problems. Everybody wants more. Everybody wants his share and that little bit extra. People, in fact, are not reasonable when it comes to their self-interest. And certainly they are less than reasonable when it comes to their needs for security. And Mr. Carter announced when he assumed office that there would be a Geneva conference by the end of 1977. He had a grand plan to bring everybody into the conference. He failed in that plan. Remember, in the early part of last spring, they were trying desperately from Washington to get the Palestine Liberation Organization to say anything that could be construed as accepting of coexistence, anything. They couldn't get a word. And you remember that he was declaring at that point in time that Syria under Assad was a peace-loving state, hoping in that way to coerce Syria to Geneva, and they wouldn't come. That policy failed. But in the process, he began to think of the issue from the point of view of what he had set as the goal, that is, convening Geneva, not what must be seen as the issue by all the states in the world, what they must live with once Geneva or any other negotiations is behind them. Now, if it's simply a question of getting everybody to Geneva, then obviously one ought to use whatever pressures one can. And since those who were unwilling to go to Geneva were all on the Arab side, let's find a way of making Israel cough up or agree to ahead of time whatever it is that the Arabs legitimately can require, legitimacy being defined as what we declare to be reasonable. We, be the third party, declare it to be reasonable, and then we'll get to Geneva. And Israel is in the position that if she declares all that she's willing to give back, there's no reason for Geneva. And if she declares all that she's willing to give back, there's no reason for any of the other states to go to Geneva, because they have it already. Israel then is put by the United States into a no-win situation, where she must dig in her heels. And dig in her heels she did. And Mr. Carter is not a man who likes to have his sense of power brooked or his judgment questioned. And we went through the spring and summer of last year watching one by one these attempts to orchestrate Geneva. All of them failed. But Mr. Carter is a man who is determined, and he picked up as if nothing had happened. Sadat went to Jerusalem. He was met there by Mr. Begin. There was great hope. And suddenly the United States intruded itself into the situation and, in a sense, brought back the very tactics into the issue which they had tried to use to get everybody to Geneva. What was the tactic? Simply this. All right, there'll be no Geneva. We'll simply call the negotiations that will take place in the Middle East Geneva. We still need a comprehensive settlement. We still need to bring everybody there. It'd be very bad somehow if Israel and Egypt would sign some kind of a separate peace negotiation agreement. Why? No one ever explained. But it would be very bad. We have to bring Jordan in. We have to bring Syria in. We have to bring the Palestinians in. And so Israel found herself again because of the position of the United States, which centered upon having the negotiations rather than the consequences of the negotiations and the final agreement. Israel found herself again being pressured by the United States to tell Hussein ahead of time exactly what Hussein can get if he comes to the new Cairo meeting or the new Jerusalem meeting. But why go to a meeting if somebody else is doing my bargaining for me ahead of the meeting, and by staying away I can get more and more and more? Because if the meeting is the end, then I lose every one of my bargaining chips once I agree to come. And so strangely, despite the urgency of our own position that there must be these negotiations and that the other parties must be in the negotiations, the very position that we took, that it's the urgency for the negotiations, made it more and more desirable, self-serving for these countries to stay away. And preachers believe, would like to believe, that if you only give to people that which they say they want, security, a nation, enough income, a decent job, whatever it be, they'll suddenly become reasonable. That's the great liberal hope. And somehow it came to Carter that if only Israel would agree to a Palestinian state, the Palestinians, because they would have been given what they want, would suddenly become sweetly reasonable people who will sit down and agree to live in peace and harmony, both with Jordan and with Israel. Now, on our doorstep, we have another example. Mr. Castro in Cuba achieved what he wanted, revolution and power. Having achieved what he wanted, he didn't cease to be the ideologue he'd always been. And Cuban troops are now deployed over half of the African continent, pursuing the ideological aims which are part of the ongoing revolution to which Mr. Castro is committed. There is no reason to believe that if Mr. Arafat or any other leader of the Palestine Liberation Organization were to achieve power in Nablus or Shechem or whatever would be the capital of the West Bank, that he would cease being the revolutionary that in fact he is, or that he would abandon his revanchist ideas for a unitary state, an Arab state controlling all of that area. The idea that giving people what you think they ought to have will suddenly make them more reasonable is a lovely idea, but it's a romantic idea. It's unrealistic. You ought to give people what they need if it is legitimate for them to have without consequence to the fact that they may in fact remain as unreasonable as you must seem to be to them. Because all of us who are in positions of privilege are obviously unreasonable to those who have less. And the idea that granting independence to the West Bank will solve the problems in the Middle East may be appealing to the preacher in the White House. But to Israel, it's another question. It's a gamble. And it's a gamble which they are not prepared to make. Because they can look to their north, and they know exactly the havoc that the Palestinian revolution has brought to Lebanon. And they can look to their east, and they know that Jordan had to fight a bloody 6 weeks war with the armies of the Palestinians and to expel them. And they know, they've only to look at history to know that the Palestinian revolution has not yet been completed, is far from being completed. And to have such a state at their doorstep with armed and powerful is a future which is frightening to them. And Mr. Carter is not only preacher, but he is the head of a state. And he has a State Department. And the State Department says to him, in effect, yes, the Palestinians ought to have a state, but no, they ought not to have a state. That is, we disagree with Israel. We want the words to be in the document, but we also agree with Israel that it would be far better if this state were linked with either Jordan or Israel. Let's talk about a plebiscite something 2 or 3 years out. And as a result, the American policy itself has an inherent confusion within it. And American policy is difficult enough for a small state such as Israel to understand. Because behind America's intrusion into the Middle East, there is always the idea Israel, as a sister democracy, with a built-in long history of amity with the United States, ought to depend upon the good word and the goodwill of the United States in working out its destiny. The only problem with that is that our recognition of our own good intentions is not cannot be measured in the same way if we look cold-bloodedly at history. In 1956, Mr. Dulles promised the Israelis that if they withdrew from the Sinai and they withdrew from the banks of the Suez Canal, they would be guaranteed free access of their shipping through the canal, they'd be guaranteed free access for their shipping through the Gulf of Eilat, and the Sinai would be demilitarized. And if the Egyptian forces moved back into, if the UN forces were ever moved out of the Sinai, Israel would be notified before that movement took place. In 1956, the Egyptians stopped the movement of the first Israeli-bound cargo through the canal, and the United States took no effective action. In 1966, Mr. Nasser blockaded at the Sharm el-Sheikh entrance to Eilat, and the United States took no effective answer. Later that week, the Egyptians ordered the United Nations forces out of the Sinai, and the United States took no effective answer. One by one, down through the years, there have been a series of broken promises or pact-filled promises. Israel remembers the 5 days that it took before Mr. Kissinger would allow the resupply of Israeli forces in 1973. Israel knows in the papers now that she was promised as part of the Sinai II agreement by the United States, the second withdrawal through the Mikla Pass, to the pass area in the Sinai, that if she withdrew, certain military supply were guaranteed to Israel, including some 100 advanced jet fighters. And yet this administration has, in the last 3 months, decided to link the sale of half the promised number of jet fighters to an unpopular sale of jets to the Saudi Arabians and to Egypt. Israel knows that she cannot simply depend upon the goodwill of the United States, and Mr. Carter, who knows that the goodwill of the United States is dependable, after all, he is the personification of the goodwill, cannot understand the Israeli position. Our own position in the Middle East, that is that of the United States, has changed markedly this last year. We spoke 2 or 3 years ago of the dangers of even-handedness. Well, today, even-handedness has become the position that the President of the United States can proclaim Mr. Sadat to be the world's foremost apostle of peace, though in fact he has done nothing but one dramatic event, the visit to Jerusalem. He has not been willing to back down on a single absolute that he spoke at Jerusalem. But he is the great apostle for peace, and Israel is an obstacle for peace. Mr. Begin is pictured. Obdurate, obstinate, all the assumptions that were there before his visit in July of last year. What's for it then? What's going to happen now in the Middle East? No one knows. It's very clear that both Egypt and Israel are trying to find some way out from under Washington. That's what was meant when Mr. Weizmann went to Cairo and was accepted in Cairo a week ago. Egypt has a great deal to gain by staying in the good graces of Washington. She wants, she has been promised $1.5 billion worth of foreign aid. Egypt in the last 3 years has received the greatest amount of foreign aid of any country, given by the United States of any country in the world. She's obviously on her way to a major military resupply by the United States. But at the same time, there is a recognition in Cairo of the weakness of the present administration. And Sadat and his advisors have read as much history as Mr. Begin and his advisors. And they know that the President of the United States vacillates, that he can change his mind almost overnight. But they better not put all of their eggs in one basket. And so even though Mr. Carter is now doing all that Mr. Sadat would wish him to do, negotiating for him, at the same time they know they must keep the contact with the Israelis. And that is, of course, all to the good. It is very clear that the rejectionist front will not break soon, that Syria, the PLO, and Libya, and Iraq are going to be adamant. They have nothing to gain at this point by joining in with the negotiations. Nor has Mr. Hussein, because he is, again, having the United States do his work for him. I think what you will see over the next few weeks or months is an increasing obstinacy on the part of Israel as it reacts to the pettiest of American pressure. The kinds of things that you've seen in the paper the last week or so at the State Department, one day after another, has leaked some presumed failure by Israel to abide by the mutual, by the agreement which undergird the sale of arms to foreign countries. I think you will see that the attempts by this administration to for some kind of change of leadership in Israel, heavy-handed and coarse as they were, will serve only to solidify the present government and allow it to remain in power longer than it might otherwise. The present administration has not been very skillful, either in its relationships with Congress or its relationships with the American people or in relationships with most governments abroad. And it's certainly true in its relationships with Israel. Because though it may make for a moment's good press that Mr. Carter talked tough to Mr. Begin, when it's read in the context of an Israeli democracy, this simply means the bully forced you to sit down and point his finger at you and wouldn't listen to anything that you were trying to say. It reads differently. I doubt that there's going to be much motion in any direction in the near term. The situation is not there. And until this administration recognizes that the negotiations which will proceed must proceed naturally, that is, because the countries involved have something to gain from it, until that point comes, and the United States pulls back from this, we know what is best for you position, and resumes the position which it tried to place 4 or 5 years ago, will simply be the honest broker pass messages back and forth and the like. Until that time comes, I doubt that there will be significant movement because there's too much advantage to playing the United States against whoever it is that you want to play the United States against. It's a very dangerous time for Israel. Dangerous time because there are forces in Washington which have long been determined to break the very special relationship which Israel has had with the United States, with the Congress, and with the American people. It's very dangerous when you read in the newspapers that it was the State Department of the United States which selected for the Saudi Arabian government the public relations advisor, the lobbyist, who would lobby through Congress the sale of jets to Saudi Arabia. It's a very dangerous thing when you read that the president's most trusted advisor had received an unsecured loan of several millions of dollars from an Arab businessman while he was still in office. It's a very serious business when you contemplate the fact that there are tremendous commercial powers, banking powers, oil powers, at work in Washington, who are determined to see to it that America's relationship to Israel is used in such a way that it will increase their ability to drill for oil and to make profits and to make banking arrangements in other parts of the globe. Increasingly, Arab money has poured into the American market, and America is now in a position where she fears the sudden withdrawal of this money from our banking system. There is power in the Arab world which was not there before, and that power is the business of Washington and obviously can be felt there. Israel must be careful in the weeks that lie ahead to make its case clear and to keep it on the case itself, not on the figure of Mr. Begin. I would hope that he would learn to keep a lower profile. I would hope that he would learn not to make these bold pronouncements which add nothing to the situation but only serve to confuse public opinion. I would hope that a series of Israelis would come to the United States and use the various forums which are available to them to express as best they can the reasons for the very complicated but very defensible position which the Israeli government has adopted vis-a-vis the various parts of any peace negotiation. Most of all, I think it's incumbent upon all of us to remember a few very simple but basic things. The first of which is, of course, that the war of 1973 was begun by the Arabs and not by Israel, was lost by the Arabs and not by Israel. It is not up to Israel to return all that was won in that war simply because the Arabs might want it. I think it's important for us to recognize that a little state with very long borders has the right to certain kinds of security arrangements, even though these may not be fit in with the desire of Americans for simple solutions to the complex problems of the Middle East. I think we ought to look at what these demands are and try to understand them in their context. A series of settlements along the Jordan River means simply a series of advanced warning stations about 15 miles from the Israel border and 35 miles from the Israel heartland. A series of settlements that are military on the Golan Heights is simply a way of protecting the settlements of the Galilee from being overrun in the first 5 minutes of the next war. Israel has reason to be concerned. 4 wars in 30 years. The rearmaments of that part of the world after each of the wars, the adamancy of the Arabs after each of these wars, the unwillingness of many groups in that world to even contemplate negotiations with Israel. The case can be made. It can be made effectively, I believe. There are forms in which it can be made. We ought to help the Israelis to do so as best we can, because there are very loud voices on the other side, very well-paid voices on the other side, who will now, and who have been for some time, trying to make it seem as though all that stands in the way of peace is the intransigence and the obstinacy of the little state of Israel. I would hope, too, that in the months that lie ahead, our own government would develop a new maturity. And I hope this not simply for the sake of Israel, but for our own sake in relationship to all parts of the world. When Israel moved into the Lebanon in response to the terrorist attack of 2 weeks ago, Israel's initial concerns were simply to weed out a few terrorist camps and terrorist pockets. But when the United States moved so swiftly and innocently to the United Nations to demand total withdrawal before these ends had been accomplished, Israel expanded her attack up to the Litani River in the hope that she might create a new set of conditions which would seal off the final border, final one of her borders, from terrorist incursion. It's interesting when you look at the Palestine Liberation Organization. They were thrown out of Egypt in 55. They were thrown out of Lebanon in 1970. They have from the very beginning been controlled, rigidly controlled by the Syrian army. It's only in the Lebanon that they were given free rein. And if this Lebanese border could be sealed, if some kind of arrangement could be worked out with the Lebanese or the Syrians, whoever controls Lebanon at the moment, much would have been done in terms of stabilizing the area of moving towards negotiations. But the precipitous action of the United States, the condemnation of invasion, the horror that was expressed about the extent of the Israeli attack, proved only to weaken whatever mandate the United Nations soldiers would have in that area. And almost guaranteed the fact that as Israel withdraws, the United Nations troops would simply allow various Palestinian groups to infiltrate among them, and the border would reopen. A more complex border than been before, because now if the Israelis shoot back, they might hit the United Nations soldiers as well as those of the Palestinians. I would hope that we would cease to be as impulsive and as innocent and as sermonic, as preachy in our foreign policy as we have been up to now. Will we be? I don't know. But I do know this, that in Israel, it's a matter of 3.5 million lives. And they're going to deal with the situation as realistically and as clear-mindedly as they can. And they are not about to do what Washington wants them to do unless it makes sense in the context of a stable and secure peace. Mr. Begin, or any successor of Mr. Begin, may end up being a fly in the ointment, somebody who stands in the way of something Washington wants to achieve. But all wisdom does not begin in the White House. And for the Israelis, wisdom begins in that which permits survival. And if we can keep that uppermost in our minds, I think we will understand why it is that they are so careful and what we often tend to be careless about. We have simple solutions. Withdraw, West Bank state, all will be peaceful. But once you begin to examine these simplicities, they're no longer simple at all. They're infinitely complex, as are the positions of all the governments and the parties involved. So I guess I'm saying this to you. Be patient with Israel. Understand her position. You won't always agree with them at the beginning. They may not always be right. But Israel is struggling to survive. And the margin of error is very thin. If she makes a single real mistake, there may be no survival. And before you move to condemn Mr. Begin as obstinate or as an obstacle to peace, before you move to condemn the policy of the settlements or any other policy, put yourself in his place. You are responsible for the lives of 3.5 million men, women, and children. To your north, you see what will happen if an Arab world army becomes dominant. Chaos and mayhem. How will you achieve their security? And how in the process can you achieve something called peace? Difficult problem. It's going to take a long time in the coming. I think it can ultimately emerge. But be careful. Let's all of us be careful of the judgment, the quick judgment which we are tempted to make.